and 2000 UTC.
Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, July 17, 2023. South Sudan starts disarming civilians around the capital, Juba.
You are tasked to go and take guns out of the hands of civilians. If you noticed the days of liberation, civilians were not allowed to carry firearms.
And Sudanese are calling for dialogue to end the violence in their country.
They stole our cars, they stole everything from our homes, and now they are living in our homes. It is really very sad.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some Sudanese living in the United States and back home in Sudan are calling on the two military factions fighting in the country to engage in genuine dialogue and restore a civilian-led government in the country. The citizens say they are concerned about sufferings caused by the three-month-old conflict, which has displaced hundreds of thousands of people. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Some Sudanese citizens say it is time for the two military factions fighting in the country to resolve their differences through dialogue. Some of the citizens say they have encountered horrific situations since the conflict began on April 15th. They say the leaders of the paramilitary rapid support forces and the Sudan Armed Forces should compromise and restore peace and stability in the country. Speaking to this program via a messaging application from Ottawa, LaSalle County in Illinois, Amel Habani says the ongoing fighting has affected her and members of her family who have been displaced. Habani says the rapid support forces have allegedly occupied her family house in Khartoum for the past 1 month.
They stole our cars, they stole everything from our homes, and now they are living in our homes. It is really very sad, and the war is seeing the people of Sudan. Till now, there is no real aid or support for them.
South Sudan in Focus reached out to Yusuf Izzet, the political advisor to the RSF's commander, for comment on this story, but he did not answer. The Sudanese army announced Sunday that its delegates are in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to engage in negotiations with the RSF. The statement did not indicate when the negotiations will begin. Khartoum resident Munira Al-Kubi says the ongoing fighting has affected women in many ways. Speaking to this program from Khartoum, Al-Kubi says she was shocked to hear reports of various forms of abuses against women and girls over the past weeks. She says the perpetrators must be held accountable.
Sexual violence have been on rise and health facilities have been significantly affected and continue to shut down. Victims do not get medical care, such as kits to prevent pregnancy and other sexually transmitted diseases.
Sudan's gender-based violence unit at the National Minister of Social Development says it has documented nearly 90 cases of sexual assault, including rape, since fighting began 3 months ago between the paramilitary RSF and the Sudan Armed Forces. In a press statement issued over the weekend, Martin Griffiths, United Nations Under-Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, said the people of Sudan have endured unspeakable suffering amid violence that is tearing their country apart. The statement further said, quote, Sudan is now one of the world's most difficult places for humanitarian workers to operate, end quote. Speaking to VOA from New York via a messaging application, Eric Kaneko, the spokesperson for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, said aid agencies are still facing difficulties in delivering assistance to the people across Sudan.
We're unable to reach the people in need. The situation is indeed worsening. It's not getting any better. And we've also, as the UN, expressed fears that Sudan is sliding into what we would call a brutal and interminable civil war.
The UN official says since the conflict began, more than 3 million people in Sudan, half of them are children, have fled the violence, both inside and outside the country, adding that 13.6 million children who are trapped in Sudan urgently need humanitarian support. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Still in Juba, some residents of the South Sudan's capital have welcomed the deployment of security forces to disarm civilians in some parts of the city. One resident says the exercise should be extended to the states to curtail cattle-related intercommunal violence. For VOA News, Dengai Deng has details from Bor.
The chief of South Sudan People's Defense Force is urging the force tasked with the disarmament exercise to collect weapons from civilians' hands peacefully. He says the disarmament team is instructed to use force when they encounter any resistance. Majak Akesh Malok is the Inspector General of the South Sudan National Police Service. He directed the forces disarming civilians to discharge their mandate according to law and avoid looting.
We don't want any soldier or any commander to take civilian property. Don't take any chicken or goat or cattle or any other belongings of the civilians. What you are going to look for is the gun only. If we take away guns from all civilians, South Sudan will be peaceful because it's guns that are causing all this insecurity in the country.
General Santino Dengwal is the chief of general staff of South Sudan's People's Defense Force, or SSPDF. Speaking to the state-run South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation, or SSBC-TV, Wall urged the security forces to remove all arms from the hands of civilians using peaceful means.
You are tasked to go and take guns out of the hands of civilians. If you notice the days of liberation, civilians were not allowed to carry firearms. If someone wants to carry a gun, he must join us and get recruited either in the police or the army. But carrying a gun anyhow is completely prohibited.
Major General Daniel Justin, the spokesperson of the South Sudan's National Police Service, says at least 900 security forces, including members of the SSPDF and police, have been deployed to disarm civilians in the outskirts of Juba. Justin says the decision was taken following recent deadly armed clashes between the army and suspected cattle raiders near the capital Juba.
Of course, we are engaging the community leaders, especially the chiefs, because there is a room for them to voluntarily hand over their arms. So we are not going to use force immediately. No, we, through the chiefs and the community leaders, we allow the youth to surrender their guns.
Job Isaac Lokule is a resident of Juba. Lokule welcomes the disarmament exercise in Juba, but says the military should disarm civilians in other states in order to curb frequent cattle-related intercommunal armed violence.
Moving with the gun every day, 24/7, it is not okay. It even makes people feel unhappy. But let the government really put more effort on it, and it has to go peacefully, not actually forcing the person to really give his own gun. But you have to have some technique, obviously, talking to this person. This person will understand that for sure he or she needs peace in this country.
A report by UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan issued last month said the presence of arms in civilians' hands has led to an increase in violence, including widespread attacks against civilians, as well as systematic sexual violence against women and girls in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Teachers at public schools in South Sudan say there are no laboratories in the country for students specializing in science subjects. A teacher in Juba says he uses theoretical knowledge to explain topics that are supposed to be taught in a laboratory. A senior official at the University of Bahr el Ghazal says secondary schools are producing half-baked students for medical schools. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
20-year-old David Ladd, a senior foreign student at Juba Day Secondary School in Juba, says he is passionate about science and wants to study medicine after completing his high school. but he says his dreams are limited by lack of laboratory at his school.
Now, if you don't know how to go to do practical work, and during the exam time, it will be difficult for you to do it, because if you don't have laboratory where you can practice, so the exam are going to be difficult for you. Even though we don't have practical, but the teachers show us, like they teach and then they tell us theories, and then they show us there is the pictures in the book. They used to tell us more, so we used to understand everything through the pictures.
George Kenyi is a head teacher at Jubadei Secondary School. He says most government schools in South Sudan lack laboratories for science students to learn practical lessons. He says teachers like him rely on theories to teach their science students.
But unfortunately, due to the numerous problems in our country at the moment, especially in government schools, we don't have active laboratories. For us in the school, yes, we have the lab room, we have some few apparatus here, but things like reagents, you will not find it easily, because as a government school, you cannot afford to buy from time to time the consumable items for the laboratory, like chemicals.
Victor Loku, Vice Chancellor of the University of Bahr El Ghazal, says lack of a strong foundation in science subjects at Sangre School is affecting most students in medical schools at South Sudan's public universities.
This is indicating something different. For example, in the College of Medicine in the University of Bahr El Ghazal, the two academic years were synchronized, and we had about 234 students. Out of 234, only 26 students passed through. This is because of the system that we have adopted in Southern Sudan.
Loku says public universities in South Sudan admit students to the colleges of medicine and engineering based on merit. Martin Tako, South Sudan's Deputy Minister of General Education, says the challenges facing the education sector in the country are enormous.
The whole system. We don't even have a teacher to instruct them in the laboratory. When we were in the secondary school, we used even to operate cats, these small rats, in the secondary school. We who studied biology, science actually in that time. But now, there's not even one. So, even if we bring the laboratories today, who will be the instructor?
Tako says 90% of South Sudan's teaching staff are volunteers due to lack of teachers' motivation from the government. In the 2022-2023 fiscal year budget, the education sector received 1.8 billion South Sudanese pounds. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayor in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, authorities shut down a radio station. Find out where and why after this break.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Africa is facing a tough year, from conflict in Sudan and the Sahel to drought, floods and other extreme weather events. But in recent interview with the head of the Africa Development Bank, Akumi Adesina is focusing on the continent's promise and how to better harness its rich environmental and human capital. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
African Development Bank President Akinwumi Adesina is looking at Africa's bottom line, but not the one used by number crunchers that looks at the value of a country's goods and services.
The way in which we measure wealth may in fact have driven many of these nature-rich countries into a higher level of debt and poverty traps.
Instead, he's pushing for another accounting method, looking at the massive natural wealth of African countries like those in the forest-rich Congo Basin, which helps absorb climate emissions, among other positive nature-based solutions.
Gabon, DRC, Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Angola. If you look at all of these countries that are in the Congo Basin area in particular, rich biodiversity, carbon sink, the largest carbon sink in the world. They get nothing for that. I've been pushing now that we need to revalue the wealth of the countries based on their natural capital.
Adesina spoke with VOA after a recent Paris summit intended to raise and rethink financing so poorer nations can tackle development and climate change. While activists say more must be done, observers say it delivered some concrete results, including a deal to restructure Zambia's $6.3 billion debt, $4 billion of which is owed to China.
I think that is good progress. It's slow, painful progress. I think we should be much faster. Creditors, time doesn't matter really so much for them, but the debtor countries can't. They need solutions now.
The West accuses China especially of pushing African countries into so-called debt traps for political or economic gain, something Beijing denies. Adesina didn't comment on that, but said China, which holds 14% of Africa's debt, must be part of other future debt solutions.
They are open to participating in collectively solving this problem for other countries. I will expect that they will have to do that anyway, given the amount of exposure that those countries have to them.
Rich nations in Paris also agreed to move $100 billion held by the International Monetary Fund into a climate and poverty fund for low-income countries. Adesina and others have been pushing for the money, part of so-called special drawing rights, or SDRs, to be channeled through the African Development Bank and similar multilateral development banks.
Every dollar of SDR that comes to us becomes it's leveraged 3 to 4 times. So the leverage factor is very, very important. And the SDR donors lose nothing. And it comes at zero cost because we actually pay an interest rate for it.
Adesina also says natural resource-backed loans that tap Africa's rich trove of oil, gas, and minerals should be off the table completely. He calls them toxic, non-transparent debts that mortgage the future of African nations. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Director. The Press Union of Liberia has criticized the shutdown of Spoon FM as a direct infringement on freedom of expression. A court in Monrovia on Friday ordered the station closed. The Spoon Network was sued last year by Wilmont Smith, the then Deputy Director General for Information Coordination at the Liberia Institute for Statistics and Geoinformation Services. Smith tells VOA's James Batty that suing media institutions silences freedom of speech and Liberia's democratic process.
The Press Union of Liberia denounced the order of the Civil Law Court to shut down Spoon Network Incorporated. We believe the action is arbitrary, intimidating, and is considered as an attack on the fundamental principles of democracy and a direct infringement on the freedom of expression and the free press.
A libel suit, or let's say defamation suit, was brought against Spoon FM since November last year. Was there a trial? How did the court reach the decision to shut the station down?
Yes, there was a trial, but I still find it difficult to understand how this rate of closure came about.
You said in your press release that the courts are being used to silence or hinder the press in Liberia. Who is using the courts to curtail press freedom in Liberia?
The court is a part of a branch of government, and there is nothing that they will do that will not have a reflection or something to do with the government or about the government.
Information Minister Lejihu Renin has said that the decision to shut down Spoon FM was strictly a legal matter and that the Liberian government did not play a role. He also said the government of President George Weah has always respected freedom of speech and the press.
The president has always respected freedom of speech. Yes, we agreed. But almost 2 years now, the Press Union of Liberia petitioned this government to investigate brutalities, harassment, and intimidation against journalists that are perpetrated by security actors and some other government officials. Up to date, we are yet to have a response from this government.
What options do you think are available to the Press Union of Liberia other than condemning the action?
The President of Liberia is urging the relevant authorities, including the Civil Law Court, to reconsider their decision and reinstate the operations of Spoon Network Incorporated. Knowing that the freedom of the press is a vital component of a functioning democracy, especially during this crucial time of our country. So the closure of this network by the court suggests a deliberate attempt to restrict or suppress the press, which is a fundamental pillar of a democratic society.
That's Wilmont Smith, former Deputy Director General for Information Coordination at the Liberian Institute of Statistics and Geoinformation Services. He spoke with VOA's Daybreak Africa host, James Batty. Rights and activists and opposition groups in Zimbabwe say President Emmerson Mnangagwa signing into a law a so-called patriotic bill is a grave attack on fundamental freedoms and rights. The new law authorizes harsh penalties, including death penalty, for anyone found guilty of willfully damaging the sovereign and national interests of Zimbabwe. Columbus Mavunga reports from the capital, Harare.
Zimbabwe's main opposition party and human rights are calling on President Emmerson Mnangagwa to repeal the law he signed into law last Friday. Fadzai Mahere is the spokeswoman of the Citizens Coalition for Change.
We condemn the signing into law of the unconstitutional patriotic bill, which will criminalize free speech and freedom of association, which are protected under our constitution. The introduction of this repressive legislation confirms beyond any doubt that Mr. Mnangagwa is worse than Robert Mugabe, and Zimbabwe has become a full-blown dictatorship and an outpost of tyranny. It now behoves all citizens to ensure that we vote decisively for change on the 23rd of August.
My record on Zimbabweans to, as she put it, vote decisively for change in the August 23rd general election. Obed Masaraure is the spokesman for another rights group, the Crisis Coalition of Zimbabwe. He says the new law is vague in its definition of offences.
Some of the penalties proposed by the law for deliberately injuring the sovereignty and national interest of Zimbabwe, such as the death penalty, long imprisonment, loss of citizenship, and banning of persons from electoral participation for 5 years, are too harsh and inappropriate for vaguely defined offences. The provision of the death penalty means that the new law violates the constitution, which only allows for the death penalty in cases of murder in aggravating circumstances. We firmly oppose the death penalty without exceptions. We are completely against the death penalty and we condemn it unreservedly.
Amnesty International said the new law is evidence that Zimbabwean authorities are bent on closing civic space as well as suppressing any form of dissent. But Lutendo Martin Harare, chairman of the pro-government Zimbabwe anti-sanctions movement, has a different view.
I'm over the moon because of the fact that the president has finally signed the criminal law amendment. I'm happy because I was one of the people that proposed it as the patriotic bill. And we are happy to see that we're beginning to get laws that punish people that go and advocate for sanctions, people that call for sanctions, people that call for the invasion of the country and destabilization of the country. I believe that this is a very good move. It puts us in step with other nations across the world that have similar laws. Let's hope it deters people and unites Zimbabweans to not sabotage their own country.
President Mnangagwa and the ruling ZANU-PF party have pushed for years for an end to Western sanctions against Zimbabwe leaders. The sanctions were imposed during the rule of the late Robert Mugabe for human rights violations and alleged election rigging. President Mnangagwa has not commented on the law known as the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Amendment Act. He signed into law last week. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that report by Mavunga brings us to the end of this show. We now leave you with Kiledi Muzika and the song Ana Barao. Been listening to Kiledi Muzika and the song My Tlangu Chuma means I'm alone. I'm your host John Tanza on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't forget to visit voafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this program, go to www.voafrica.com/South Sudan. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and engineer Adrius Regis, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is clear we have not done nearly enough to protect children from the impacts of conflict, declared Jeffrey De Laurentiis, acting U.S. Deputy Representative to the United Nations. This year's report on children and armed conflict provides a sobering snapshot of how conflict has harmed children, said Ambassador De Laurentiis.
In 2022, the United Nations reported 27,180 instances of the six grave violations against children, including more than 8,600 children killed or maimed. We are deeply saddened by this staggering number. We are encouraged by the outcome of engagement with parties to conflict, which resulted in the release of 12,460 children from armed groups and armed forces, and hope for more steps that will make children's lives better.
Nevertheless, too many children have been subjected to sexual violence, abducted, and denied humanitarian aid, said Ambassador De Laurentiis.
In Sudan, there are reports of children who have been forced from their homes and in some cases separated from their families or subjected to sexual violence. Armed groups remain the main perpetrators of abuses against children in Colombia, where the forcible recruitment or use of children remains a prevalent concern, particularly for Afro-Colombian and indigenous communities in rural areas.
In Afghanistan, the ban on girls' access to education beyond primary school, patterns of early and forced marriage, and the recruitment and use of child soldiers have been detrimental to the physical and emotional well-being of youth. In Ukraine, members of Russia's forces have committed execution-style killings of Ukrainian men, women, and children, and alongside other Russian officials have deported hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian civilians to Russia, including children who have been forcibly separated from their families. This stark reality, said Ambassador De Laurentiis, serves as a poignant reminder of the urgency and necessity of strengthening the international community's child protection capacities and for the crucial need for all states to respect international law and the principles enshrined in the UN Charter. Children around the world deserve to feel safe, to receive an education, to have a future, stressed Ambassador De Laurentiis. When we take steps to protect children, we are safeguarding our collective future and helping to end enduring conflicts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.